What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Leti Cotton Pogrebin, the prominent Jewish feminist and author of the new book, How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who's Sick. We'll also have a visit from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Borel. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom and Lashana Tova. This morning, it's a little complicated how we are supposed to greet one another in Jewish tradition. Yesterday was Yom Kippur, holiest day of the year, and a fast day on which we neither ate nor drank for 24 hours. On Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, we greet each other with the phrase, Gemara Chatima Tova, may you be sealed in the Book of Life for a good year, or we shorten it and say, Gemar Tov. So it's okay to still be saying that today, although, technically speaking, it ended last night with the conclusion of Ne'ilah, the locking of the gates of repentance at the end of the Day of Atonement. So I could start out today by saying Gemar Chatima Tova and not be wrong. It's also still very early in the Jewish New Year, this being just the 11th day of 5774, so it's also still okay to say L'Shana Tova, a good New Year. In fact, some of my own New Year's greeting cards from our family didn't go out until last week, I'm afraid, so it's possible that some won't actually arrive until tomorrow. A little late, but still appropriate for the beginning of what we hope will be a healthy and good New Year. So, L'Shana Tova to everybody, once again. But the most appropriate greeting this morning comes because the longest Jewish holiday of all, and one of the most pleasurable, begins this coming Wednesday night. It's the 8-day-long combination festival of Sukkot, Shmini Atzeret, and Simchat Torah, which continues from this Wednesday night all the way to next Thursday night, and if you are Orthodox or conservative, all the way to a week from Friday night, and then you start Shabbat. And the correct greeting on Sukkot is Chag Sameach, a happy holiday, since this is supposed to be the happiest time of year, called in Hebrew Zman Simchatenu, the season of our joy. So, Chag Sameach. But we're not done yet. Because, in addition to Chag Sameach, you can also say, in a kind of more educated, fancier greeting, Moadim L'Simcha, which means may you have holidays of joy. And then the person you greet is supposed to knowingly reply, Chagim Uzmanim L'Sason, which means holidays and times of celebration back to you. So, let's try that as our greeting today. I'll say, Moadim L'Simcha, and you say back, Chagim Uzmanim L'Sason. Okay, here we go. Moadim L'Simcha. Not so sure that worked well. Perhaps we should keep it simpler. How about just going with the Yiddish phrase, Gud Yontif? Actually, that one's not quite usable until the holiday actually begins, or at the earliest, just the day before the holiday itself, like Wednesday of this week. Which means we probably should just stick to Chag Sameach, which for some unknown sociological reason is okay to say even a few days early. One last add on how to greet people in this complicated Jewish holiday season. Way back in 1991, when I was living in Israel, I set up a program in Jerusalem for rabbinic, cantorial, and education students to go to an immigrant absorption center and play with kids and teach Hebrew to adults and kids. Well, my own Hebrew name is Simcha, which means joy or celebration, as in Moadim L'Simcha, to which you were supposed to reply, Chagim Uzmanim L'Sason, right? Like I just taught you on the festival of Sukkot. Anyway, one day at the absorption center during Sukkot, way back in 1991, I was playing soccer with some young kids, and afterwards they introduced me to their families. One of the very nice Ethiopian older brothers and I had a good chat in our kind of rudimentary conversational Hebrew. At the end of it, I stuck out my hand and said, Shmi Simcha, which means my name is Simcha, to which he answered, Sason. I thought he was doing a short version of the Sukkot greeting, so I said, Ah, Chag Sameach. And then he said, No, his name was Sason. And there we were, Simcha v'Sason, between us named Joy and Celebration, and we were meeting on Sukkot, the Festival of Joy. Good timing, no? All of which is a long prelude to telling you that Sukkot, the Festival of Booths or Tabernacles, which begins this week, is one of my favorite holidays of all. Although it occurs much too soon after the end of the High Holy Days, there are just 4 days from Yom Kippur until the beginning of Sukkot, it is filled with lovely rituals and experiences that make it a truly pleasurable holiday. The fall harvest festival for our people, Sukkot combines elements of agriculture, construction, al fresco dining, guests, parties, and Thanksgiving into a truly delightful mix. No wonder it's Zman Simchatenu, the season of our joy. And so, to play us in this morning after Yom Kippur, and as we prepare for Sukkot, here's a very silly cover by the fun, popular group The Maccabees, a recent past guest of Too Jewish. It's called Sukkah Style, a parody of the enormous worldwide Korean hit Gangnam Style.
Shake your palm frond, myrtle citron, and willow, and willow. Shake your palm frond, myrtle citron, and willow, and willow.
Oppam Sukkah Style. Sukkah Style. Oppam Sukkah Style. Sukkah Style.
Simchas Torah.
Oppam Sukkah Style.
Simchas Torah.
That was Sukkot Style. I think the Maccabees capture the spirit of the holiday in a very silly parody of that mega-hit melody. Traditionally on Sukkot, we invite guests to join us in our sukkah, our temporary booth that we build just for this week of the festival. Family, friends, new arrivals in town, visitors, everybody is supposed to have a place to go for Sukkot. But in addition, we symbolically also welcome our patriarchs and matriarchs into our sukkah. Straight out of the Bible come Abraham and Sarah, then Isaac and Rebecca, then Jacob, Leah and Rachel, then Joseph, Moses, Aaron and King David. They all come into our humble huts to celebrate the fall harvest and thank God in style. And so, to play us in this morning, on this theme of guests in our sukkah, here's a happy melody for Sukkot from the Dimyon Orchestra, and it's called Ushpizin, the name that we use for these special symbolic guests on Sukkot.
Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Yosef, Moshe, Aharon, David. Azamein, azamein, v'sudasi.
That was Ushpizin, a song for Sukkot that starts this very week, inviting you to bring guests into your sukkah. It's starting this Wednesday night, outdoors, right near you. Our guest this morning, the renowned feminist and author Letty Cotton Pogrebin has a new book out on how to visit the sick and how not to visit them. Find out what works and what doesn't when we return right here on Too Jewish. Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org.
A Taste of Judaism, the largest and most successful outreach program in the country, celebrates its 14th anniversary year. Over 5,000 people have completed the course offered by Temple Emmanuel, Arizona's first congregation. Now, it's your turn. Taste of Judaism is free and open to all, Jewish or not. Rabbi Sam Kohan and Rabbi Batsheva Appel explore the history and practice of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on spirituality, values, and community. Taste of Judaism is an exciting opportunity for anyone who wants to gain an understanding of Jewish culture, history, rituals, community, and practice. The class includes delicious tastes of traditional Jewish foods. Taste of Judaism offers daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, and East Tucson, plus the very popular Taste of Judaism Family Class, held at Tucson Hebrew Academy. Adults enjoy a grown-up taste class, while kids enjoy Jewish stories, crafts, and activities with excellent THA teachers. There's no fee or obligation, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Mila Vassar at 520-327-4501 for more information and to register today. That's 520-327-4501.
We are delighted to welcome the two Jewish art guests this morning, Letty Cotton Pogrebin, author, activist, lecturer, founding editor and writer for Ms. Magazine. She's also the author of 10 books, 2 memoirs, 1 novel, and the recently published How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who's Sick. She's edited anthologies, won an Emmy Award, and has been a prominent writer and speaker about Jewish issues and Jewish women's issues and Israeli-Palestinian issues for a few years now. We welcome Letty Cotton Pogrebin. Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi. Nice to talk to you.
So what prompted you to write a book about supporting those we care about who are ill?
Well, actually, it began, as many things do for writers, with personal experience. I was diagnosed with breast cancer the day after Yom Kippur in 2009. I didn't even have time to commit a single sin. I was totally cleansed, and I got sort of zapped with this news when I went for a mammogram. And I noticed that my friends reacted to me in all sorts of ways, some helpful, some, you know, sort of neutral, and some actually hurtful. And one day, several months later, when I was in Memorial Sloan Kettering waiting for my radiation treatments, I thought, you know, I'm going to just Google this and find a book on how to deal with friends when you're sick and how friends should deal with you, because I'm not having a good experience here,
right,
in many cases. And there was no such book, so I decided to write one, and then I thought, you know, I have cancer, I'm having radiation, I really should report the story, go around and get a wider sample than just a Jewish woman from the Upper West Side of Manhattan, which was my demographic, and I should talk to a bunch of people from different racial groups, religious ages, so on, and people with different illnesses. And then I looked around the waiting room, and there was my sample. There were people, black, white, Hispanic, Asian. There were people who had come from all over the country. There were people who didn't just have cancer, but had been through anything you could think of. And I turned to one of them, and I said, "Hi. I'm like a cohort of you. I'm also here for treatment, but I'm writing a book about friendship and illness. May I interview you?" And that was it. I was off and running. People were eager to talk to me. They gave me the most remarkable and illuminating anecdotes. And from that, I wrote a book that's part memoir and part sort of how-to.
You know, it's a very interesting thing. The whole concept of Bikur Cholim, of visiting the sick, is integral in Jewish life.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody really gets taught how to do it. We hope that rabbis and cantors and clergy who are involved get some training.
More than that, Bikur Cholim, which, as you say, I mean, it's a mitzvah, it's a commandment.
Central mitzvah.
Central and repeated. And in fact, the world's great religions have an analog to it in one form or another.
Right.
But it's very often completely counter to what the sick person wants. That was one of the great surprises of my interviews. Most people did not want to be visited in the early days of their illness at all, even when their clergy person showed up, and very often the clergy person overstayed. So I have a whole chapter on visits that really does kind of, as Jews, force us to say maybe Hillel should trump Bikur Cholim. I mean, Hillel said, do not do unto others what you would not have done unto you, and most of us don't want to be visited, especially early on. So maybe we need to save the Bikur Cholim or revisit it in our community, in conversation, and be more honest and up to date about what serves people's needs the best. If you are nauseous, tired, exhausted from surgery, and somebody comes, you know, bounding in their yoga clothes, visiting you, you know, with the best of intentions, it doesn't make you feel good.
We will explore that further when we come back with Letty Cotton-Pergreben, whose new book is called How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who's Sick. It's an important book, and who's done a great deal in the Jewish world besides that. When we come back, we'll hear about it on Too Jewish.
If you're like most people, your biggest purchase is your home. Don't you wish there was someone you could turn to who not only had knowledge and experience, but who truly cared about you? If you're looking to buy or sell a home, you need to know Jill Rich. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. With over 20 years of experience, Jill's one of Tucson's top realtors. She specializes in all kinds of residential property. She can find you a starter house or a castle. Jill will find you the perfect home. While the stock market has wild gyrations, real estate grows in value. If you want to invest in income property, Jill can guide you. And if you're thinking about selling your home, Jill provides a personal marketing program to sell your house fast. You can reach Jill Rich at Realty Executives River Road Office, 615-8400. Jill provides strong representation in a caring way. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. Jill Rich, call 615-8400.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism at Kvetcher-Kfell, please email us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio. Or visit our website, TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, or download us from there or from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our Mivina on Israel, Oshrat Bar-El, head of the Weintraub Israel Center here in Tucson. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
And an early Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
We were talking last week about how when Moroccan Jews came to Israel in the 1950s, early 60s, they were settled mostly in development cities, development towns, and they were able to come when the king let them leave Morocco. Before that, it wasn't possible, really. And they were put there for Zionist reasons by the Israeli government to reinforce the south, the north, where there weren't as many people, where there was political danger of invasion. Those development towns became a kind of the term that's used in Israel is a periphery versus the center. Can you explain that to our listeners?
Actually, periphery, like in terms, periphery, it's not just a geographical term. Periphery, which means it can be cultural,
educational,
and so on and so forth. But of course, the process began not now, but at the early days when you just mentioned that the Israel needed to absorb too many new immigrants, so, and the building wasn't ready. So they use ma'abarot, like a transitions house.
Kind of a tent, really, a fancy tent,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, some of them was tent. And actually, just for the fact, it was all over. So you can find some ma'abarot in Tel Aviv also, not just in the south.
Yeah, not just way out there.
Yeah, but in the north and the south, it take longer to move them to our buildings. My family, for instance, were lucky to have a house, like an apartment, actually, in a building. Some of them that came earlier, because my mother parents came at the 62, but those who come earlier lived in a Ma'abarot. And the Ma'abarot, all these transitions, transition house, create actually they land the background for creating the gaps, since
that was the origin of the gaps within Israeli society.
Yeah, because as I told you last week, some of them left big houses
in Casablanca and Marrakesh,
yeah, in
and
Fez,
Rabat. They had a substance,
and they needed to adjust to their very new
primitive conditions.
Yeah.
Israel was a very poor country in those days.
Mm-hmm. And it was tough for some of them. And, you know, and they needed to fight for a day-to-day living instead of, like, just invest in education. And this creates some of the gaps that actually we're facing with some of them even until today in some of the cities.
Some of the development cities. We will explore some of those issues when we come back next week. And should note, you have a big open house coming up next Sunday, Chag Sameach, celebrating Sukkot, and people can contact the Jewish Federation to find out more of Southern Arizona. Thanks, and Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
When we come back on Too Jewish, you'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in Southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom. Happy day after Yom Kippur.
Good morning, Rabbi, and I hope your new year is off to an excellent start.
We showed, before all the Jewish high holy days, the film The Gatekeepers at our Slichot program at my Temple Emmanuel. It's a film that does interviews with the former heads of the Shin Bet, the Sherut Bitachon, the Israeli Secret Service, charged with keeping peace in the territories, also internally in Israel a bit, kind of like the FBI, not exactly. Very interesting film, available everywhere, Netflix, Amazon Prime. You saw it recently, too. Let's talk about it a little bit.
Yeah, I thought it was a fascinating film. I encourage your listeners to obtain it by whatever means and to watch it.
Legal means, of
course. Right, of course. It is mostly subtitled, although all of these retired directors of the Shin Bet can speak English and liberally pepper their conversation in Hebrew with English phrases like a win-win solution or whatever, better late than never. I mean, there are a lot of phrases. It's interesting. But nonetheless, if you really hate subtitled films, this film is perhaps not for you. That being said, remarkably, I thought, there were at least five or six former directors of this highly secretive organization who talked openly and in what was obviously a non-scripted way about their work, about their concerns, about how, as one guy put it, after you retire from this work, you inevitably become more left-leaning and more in favor of peace. The sort of one who came off as being the gentle, wise old man, the sort of Yoda of all these guys, said, talk to anyone. It's better to talk than not to talk. However outrageous a given group is, whether it's Hamas or anybody else, the Islamic Jihad, whatever, you have to talk. And that's one of the first rules of being an intelligence operative, is you talk to every possible source, then you sift through the information, and you eventually come to a judgment as to its credibility. What I thought was particularly interesting about this film was how each of these guys revealed a concern with the ethics of their work, with the type of methods used, with the ultimate objectives of their work. It's hard to imagine a CIA director or an FBI director expressing the same types of concerns with the same degree of sensitivity and preoccupation with ethics about tactics such as waterboarding, for example, which would never have been tolerated by the Shin Bet. I mean, even one thing that was considered controversial was nonviolent, but sort of shaking a guy by the shoulders to shake him up and to demonstrate that you were in charge. So normally that never resulted in any kind of injury or pain. It was just a symbolic thing. But there was one case where it was like a shaken baby syndrome, and the guy had some loose wiring in his brain, and he died as a result. So even that practice was banned because of that one case.
Yeah, I mean, that's one person who died in detention in that.
Right.
In Israel, I can't imagine how many people we don't know about that died at Guantanamo or in any Abu Ghraib, any of the other places where Americans were involved.
Right. That was one of the many remarkable things about this film. I'd like to go on maybe next week and discuss some of the other aspects of the film and some of the substance, actually, of what has preoccupied these guys over the years.
It's a great, great story. And listen, Chag Sameach, a happy holiday of Sukkot.
Thank you.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. This one, a little bit of a leftover from Yom Kippur yesterday. A Reform rabbi was such a compulsive golfer that once, Yom Kippur morning, he left the house very early and went out for a quick 9 holes by himself. An angel was looking on and immediately notified his superiors that a grievous sin was being committed. On the 6th hole, God caused a mighty wind to take the ball directly from the tee to the cup. A miracle shot. The angel was horrified. "A hole in one!" he exclaimed. "This you call a punishment, Lord?" And God said with a sly smile, "So, who can he tell?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, a special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. You can tell the joke. And now a word of Torah. This week we read special selections from the Torah in honor of the holiday of Sukkot, or Sukkos. This season is an embarrassment of holiday riches for Jews, and the Torah readings reflect this. Sukkot marks the great fall Thanksgiving festival, the Feast of Tabernacles, when we are commanded to remember the transitory nature of our ancestors wandering through the wilderness of Sinai, as well as the transitory nature of our own lives. In the season of the fall harvest, we eat the first and best produce of the natural world, and we take a week to demonstrate our gratitude for the necessities of life, food, shelter, and clothing. And in this week's Torah readings, we receive the mitzvah of building a sukkah, a temporary tabernacle, booth, or hut outdoors, designed to last just a week, actually 8 days, to eat in and perhaps sleep in. We decorate it with the symbols of the harvest, fruits and vegetables, and enjoy a fall festival to celebrate the goodness of the world that God has given us. Enjoyment is the key. This is our Zman Simchatenu, the season of our joy, when we are literally commanded to celebrate our good fortune. It's a great lesson in appreciating the gifts we've received and appreciating the many good things we already have. Gratitude is an experience few of us can maintain for long, but it's the essential source of much that is profoundly religious and profoundly good. May we each find a way to be grateful during this week dedicated to gratitude. But while gratitude and joy are the prevailing themes of the Festival of Sukkot and its Torah readings, there's one special additional reading we include on the festival that is not from the Torah itself. It is instead from the latter stages of the Bible, the Ketuvim, or writings. Ecclesiastes Kohelet, the beautiful biblical book that is chanted on Shabbat Sukkot, is perhaps the single most beautiful piece of literature in all history, succinct, poetic, gorgeous, and wise. It includes famous phrases that have become part of our language, including "the sun also rises," "there is nothing new under the sun," "all rivers run to the sea, but the sea is not full," "for everything there's a time, a season for every purpose under heaven," "the earth returns to the dust that it was, but the spirit returns to God who gave it," and so on. The conclusion of Ecclesiastes is simple but powerful. After a poetic search of wisdom and folly, a survey of what the world has to offer us, the author writes, "The conclusion of the matter, all having been heard, is to revere God, keep the mitzvot. That makes the complete human being." As autumn approaches, Kohelet reminds us that so much of what we do is vanity. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity, the book begins, and compels us to realize that God is our true source of meaning and beauty. At this joyous time of year, it is a sobering but truly magnificent reminder of all that really matters. Even, perhaps especially, at seasons of joy and times of gladness, we need to remember that our greatest success comes from our integrity and our belief. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, acclaimed Jewish feminist and author Leti Cotton Pogrebin, will tell us what prompted her to write a book about how to help people when they are sick or their family members are sick. Find out when we return on To Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million-dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In what has become a genuine international soap opera, President Barack Obama's threat to bomb Syria after it clearly used chemical weapons on its own citizens in the nasty Syrian civil war has now stretched out for weeks. It's almost as though our president, who is lobbying Congress to approve the strikes, has now created an elaborate national debate about whether or not he should send missiles at Assad's regime. To be honest, all the administration's protests to the contrary, it is beginning to sound like, "Please, stop me from bombing Syria," which I suspect is what will happen. Russia, Syria's principal patron for many decades, prevented the UN from taking concerted action against the brutal Assad regime. Now they are going to have Syria turn over its chemical weapons to Russia, or at least some of its weapons, and claim to have served as international peacekeepers. Russia gets to flex its muscles and look like a good guy. Syria doesn't get bombed, although it continues to suffer through its brutal civil war. And President Obama doesn't actually have to order military action. Of course, at the same time, Russia has announced it will sell long-range missiles to Iran, capable of reaching Israel, as well as sophisticated anti-aircraft systems that threaten the IDF's mastery of the Middle Eastern skies. So, Russia gets to have it both ways, which certainly and correctly makes Israel even more nervous. Now, a new war front in Syria with the U.S. fighting alongside the Syrian rebels, who include everybody from true democracy fighters to al-Qaeda, is not an attractive prospect. But letting the brutal Assad regime slaughter people with poison gas cannot be an acceptable solution in the year 2013. According to the intelligence community's reports, Assad's troops have used chemical weapons not once, but 15 different times in the past year. This is no isolated incident. Look, I'm not sure there's a good solution here, but as the political lobbyists for the Jewish community, like AIPAC, rally for President Obama's tepid approach to waging war, it must be said that we continue to hope for a successful diplomatic solution. And that this has been a fascinating lesson in how to, well, not wage war. If that was the intent of the president all along, it has apparently succeeded. Whether it will in any way deter Assad, or calm the civil war in Syria, or make it more humane, is much less clear. In the continuation of the story of Prisoner X, Israel will pay more than $1 million to the family of Ben Zagir, an alleged Mossad agent who committed suicide in an Israeli prison about 3 years ago. Zagir, a Melbourne native, was arrested in January 2010 by Israel's Shin Bet Secret Service and jailed in secrecy under the name Prisoner X until he committed suicide in an isolation cell in Ayalon prison about 10 months after his arrest. The case was shrouded in secrecy until the Australian Broadcasting Corporation exposed Zagir's identity back in February of this year. Zagir was held by Israel for having committed treason while working as an Israeli secret agent. The reason the state agreed to pay this sum stemmed from its desire to avoid a court hearing in which details that could harm national security might be revealed, Israel's justice ministry said. The ministry said the payment was not an admission of fault for the suicide. Zagir's family reportedly had accused Israel of negligence. The agreement with the family, reached after extensive negotiations, secret ones I'm sure, contains a confidentiality clause. Zagir's family declined to speak to either Australian or Israeli media. A prosecutor's report released in April found that there was evidence that Zagir died after committing suicide as a result of failures by the Israel Prison Service, but there was not enough evidence to bring criminal charges against the service or any of its specific personnel. The case, however, has not been closed, which means Israeli prison officials could still be charged with negligence in Zagir's death at a later date. The report also said that Zagir attempted suicide twice during his 9 months in prison, saw three psychiatrists, and met with social workers some 57 times. Well, while we know that as Jews we have many co-religionists that we are very proud of, we also know that we have some we are ashamed of. And this is one of those stories, almost painfully so. It turns out that a group of drug pushers from Sheepshead Bay, Brooklyn, texted their hours to customers and warned them that they closed for Shabbat, according to an indictment unsealed last week in New York. The indictment accuses the five guys of conspiracy for sending texts to customers announcing drugs for purchase, such as DOB, the brand name of a heroin that they sold. The messages repeatedly warn customers against arriving after sundown Friday or before sundown on Saturday. "We are closing 7:30 on the dot," one text said. "We will reopen Saturday 8:15, so if you need anything, you have 45 minutes to get what you want." That text was sent to 50 recipients. The men are accused of peddling heroin, oxycodone, cocaine, and other drugs from their Bedford Avenue drug warehouse. NYPD officers raided the drug den on April 20th after a nearly year-long investigation called, get this, Only After Sundown, with the Office of the Special Narcotics Prosecutor. The crew was in possession of more than 23,000 oxycodone pills. They had a street value of $460,000. The guys are alleged to have used a variety of methods to obtain the drugs, including stolen prescription sheets. Prosecutors say the Orthodox men were in possession of a sawed-off shotgun. Maybe it had a bris, too. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. She's Letty Cotton-Pogrebin, author, activist, lecturer, founding editor and writer for Ms. Magazine. She won an Emmy for How to Be You and Me, which was a couple of years ago, but Free to Be You and Me. I can't believe I said that. Right. It's How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who's Sick is the new book, but Free to Be You and Me, of course. I'm not going to say it's from my childhood. That wouldn't be entirely true. She's also the author of Deborah, Golda, and Me, Being Female and Jewish in America, and I think 8 other books. Has written regularly for many publications, including Moment Magazine, where I've had the privilege of reading her for, it seems like a while. We were talking and been on the board of many outstanding organizations and interesting ones, worked for Israeli-Palestinian Peace. We were talking earlier about your new book and the whole concept of Bikur Cholim, what it means to visit the sick, when is it a good idea, when is it not such a good idea, what's the right way to do it?
And how to talk to the patient.
Let's talk about that.
We don't have any guidelines. Nobody really just kind of introduces this into the etiquette of life. But the etiquette of illness is so important because we do what we think is right. Like we send a basket of fruit covered in cellophane. You know, you get three of these things. You're not suddenly a fruit maven. You're not suddenly desperate to eat, you know, jellied kumquat.
Well, and lots of times you can't, anyway.
You can't, exactly. Or people send flowers, oblivious to the fact that the, you know, hospital rooms are already full of flowers, half of them dead. And instead of bringing something that's really uniquely appropriate for that person in their condition, we need to particularize. And when we, and when we think of a present, for example, you know, the best thing to get somebody might be a certificate for a tank full of gas because suddenly they have this jump in their expenses because they have to drive themselves to treatments three times a week.
Well, and then they have to deal with all of the deductibles and the out-of-pocket expenses,
yes,
and it's a complicated
exactly.
mess.
People need, more than anything else, a little cash infusion. So you don't necessarily want to, you know, challenge their pride by giving them actual cash, but you can give a gift certificate. Give them a certificate for a massage. Make them feel good. Bring them pleasure, which is what they have the least of when they're sick. And as far as what to say, I mean, oddly enough, there are three things that I hated hearing when I was sick, during the beginning of my whole cancer ordeal. I did not want to hear, "You look great." Everyone was saying, "You look great," and they never usually say, "You look great," every 5 minutes, so you automatically know you don't look great. And it's a reminder that people are lying to you. People are bucking you up with fake stuff. The second thing was, believe it or not, "How are you?" "How are you" in normal discourse is something we answer with, "Fine, great, terrific." But when you're sick, you have to calibrate your answer to "How are you?" Do I really want to tell them how I am? Do they have the patience to listen? You know, will it change their view of me? Will it change my my employability if someone from the office asks, "How are you?" and I might have to answer honestly? So it becomes a complicated question. And if you know somebody is sick, you might not want to say that. You might want to just say, "What's new?"
One of the greatest lessons I learned came from a rabbi who said, "Don't go in and say, 'How are you?' because if they were so well, they wouldn't be here. Say, 'How are they treating you?'"
Right. That's a very good Jewish question. How are they treating you? How's the food?
Right.
You know,
are they letting you get any sleep here? Do they come in at 3 a.m. with tests?
See what happens to our tone of voice?
Yeah, you sound more Jewish. It's somehow more agreeable in these circumstances.
It's more intimate. It's more real. And that brings me to the whole issue of honesty. If you can start out, and this is the key takeaway from the book, How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who's Sick. If you can start out the minute a friend tells you his or her diagnosis by saying, "Look, I don't want to murmur cliches and bromides. I don't want to do the wrong thing, and I really am not good at this. So I'm going to need some guidance in order to be helpful to you. Please tell me the following three things. Tell me what's helpful and what's not. Tell me when you want to be alone and when you want company. And tell me what to bring and when to leave." And if you establish those ground rules early on, you will never mess up. You will never feel awkward. The sick person will never be ill-served. Three easy questions to open the door to honesty. You know, tell me what's helpful and what's not. Tell me when you want to be alone and when you want company. Tell me what to bring and when to leave. I just wish people could do that. I wish people had done that with me.
So I will share something. In reading the book, the thing that occurred to me is how often I'll say, "Do you want me to come out to the house for a visit? Do you want me to come by?" And they'll say, "No, Rabbi, you know, don't. I don't feel like it," or "You're so busy," or whatever it is they say. And then 3 weeks later, I'll hear through the grapevine that they're very upset that I didn't go visit them. Now, I know it's different with a rabbi, but not entirely. If a close friend says, "Oh, do you want me to come?" it sounds sometimes to people like they're begging off.
Because most people say it and don't mean it, and because they probably think to themselves, the rabbi has a million other people, probably some worse off, so maybe I shouldn't say yes, maybe it'll be selfish. The thing I believe that would bring this to a different level is after you say the thing everyone says, like, "Tell me when I could come, should I come, what can I bring?" You have to say, "I really mean it. I'm not just saying it. I know everyone says it, but I really mean it." And you as a rabbi probably need to say, "You know, I really want to make time for you if you want me, but I don't want to come if you're feeling so bad that you don't want company." It needs that second and third sentence.
Right.
Because otherwise it lapses into the area of cliche.
Yeah.
having just had surgery myself not too long ago, I can tell you that visits are exhausting.
Yes. My husband, who had a hip replacement surgery, and I write about
yes.
in the book, one of many, many anecdotes, my husband absolutely laid down the law, no visitors, and it was driving me crazy because it was a week and we didn't see anybody, and finally I said, I need visitors.
Yeah. So,
and so he allowed me to invite our neighbors and friends. And that, by the way, was the occasion for me to talk about the perfect present, because the male part of the couple was a tennis partner of my husband's. And one of the things my husband felt, maybe you did too, is I will never play tennis again.
Yeah.
I love tennis.
Oh, yeah.
I won't be able to.
I can't go running. I won't have the camaraderie. Yeah, of course.
You can't imagine yourself doing those things when you first come out of hip surgery.
Right.
And this guy, Max, brought one simple 398 or 298 can of tennis balls. That was his present. That was his get well present. Couldn't have been more perfect.
That's great. Yeah, I had a friend who came over a few days after surgery, his close friend, and he said, we'll get you in the pool. You'll be swimming. Here's, you know, you tell me when, I'll get you in there. And I was like, really?
That's good. That's perfect.
And he's right. It's going to turn out.
Sooner than you could play tennis.
That's sooner than I could play tennis. That's okay. You know, doctor, will be able to play the violin? No, sure. Well, I never could before.
Speaking of doctors, Rabbi, you mentioned the whole issue of the contradictions with Bikur Cholim.
Right.
And I wanted to mention for your observant Jewish listeners,
sure.
that I spoke at a Chabad conference, of all things. I was really very pleased to be invited, and I learned a lot, and they were very open to my message. And one of the things that a doctor asked is, you know, we are constrained by halakha, by Jewish law, to not make a person feel worse with bad news. So he said, I am constantly on the horns of a dilemma. Like telling the truth and make them feel bad, you know? Or do I sort of finesse it and be, you know, and be, perform according to the halakhic demand that I not increase their pain? You know, and in some cases, state law requires a doctor to tell the truth. You can actually be prosecuted for not telling the truth.
Right.
So he was stuck. You know, he was stuck, and he tried to find ways to inform the family, to have the family convey the truth, rather than his breaking the halakha. So I think that, you know, we have a wonderful, brilliant tradition, and I marvel all the time at the wisdom of the sages, and how did they know that 3,000 years ago? But there are moments when it's tough, it's really tough if you're an observant Jew to follow through on these prescriptive mitzvot.
You know, and there's always another opinion. The truth is halakha, as complex and structured as it is also flexible and rich in many different traditions.
Exactly.
And Maimonides may have had different ways of doctoring 900 years ago, but that doesn't mean, as brilliant as he was, maybe the most brilliant human being who ever lived, doesn't mean we don't have ways of making it more acceptable for today's world.
I also discovered, I mean, again, since your show is called Too Jewish, when I was interviewing people in the waiting room at Sloan Kettering, I came across a chassid who was sitting there with the shtarm on the payas and a long black coat. And I tried to engage him in conversation, and he wouldn't answer. And I thought, well, maybe he doesn't speak English. And I tried with my combination of mamalosh and of Yiddish.
Well, Yiddish, right.
To communicate with him, and finally, you know, it came out, and I tell the whole story in the book, it came out that he didn't want to talk about friendship and illness because he hadn't told anybody he was sick. I said, how could you do that in your community where Bikur Cholim must be really, really helpful? And, you know, you all come through for each other. That's at least my impression. And he said, no, no. He said they would do Lashon Hara, evil tongue. They would do bad gossip about me. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, I have three daughters to marry off. If anyone knows that I have cancer, they'll think it's genetic, and they won't want their family, their daughter to marry into my family.
Mm.
So this poor guy had to carry his illness alone. None of his friends could come through for him because they didn't know. And Bikur Cholim became like a theoretical in his community. And when I said that to the Chabad, the gathering in Alexandria, Virginia, in June, to the Chabadniks, they all admitted this is a problem. That if you have to make a shidduch, a match, you have to really factor in the fact that a lot of people draw conclusions from a parent's illness that it's going to be in the genes. So again, that makes us really have to sit up straight as Jews and talk about what the, you know, the good stuff in our tradition sometimes bad spawns some bad stuff. And I would like very much for us to have a discussion about all this at conferences, meetings, and in your pastoral experiences and other rabbis. I just think it's very important to talk about the Shonda factor, the scandal disgrace factor that a lot of Jews still carry about the big C, for example, or cerebral palsy, or whatever you have in your family,
right,
that you hide. You know, which is a carryover I know very well from being raised by an immigrant woman who hid
sure.
her cancer.
And you know, it's not just immigrants that do that. We're all a little shocked and stunned and horrified. Not everybody puts it right up on Facebook.
Right.
Exactly. It's a different experience. Letty, I'd intended to ask you lots of stuff about Jewish feminism and the standing of Jewish women today and other issues. And
for another conversation.
You have to let me call you back.
Okay, someday, sure.
Someday, hopefully not too long. Her book is called How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who's Sick. I think it's an excellent, very helpful guide for anyone who deals with this, and frankly, all of us deal with it at some point along the way, and more as we get older. Thank you so much. A good year, a healthy year, and Chag Sameach.
Good year, and Gemar Tov. Bye-bye.
Gemar Tov. Bye-bye.
A Taste of Judaism, the largest and most successful outreach program in the country, celebrates its 14th anniversary year. Over 5,000 people have completed the course offered by Temple Emmanuel, Arizona's first congregation. Now, it's your turn. Taste of Judaism is free and open to all, Jewish or not. Rabbi Sam Kohan and Rabbi Batsheva Appel explore the history and practice of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on spirituality, values, and community. Taste of Judaism is an exciting opportunity for anyone who wants to gain an understanding of Jewish culture, history, rituals, community, and practice. The class includes delicious tastes of traditional Jewish foods. Taste of Judaism offers daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, and East Tucson, plus the very popular Taste of Judaism Family Class, held at Tucson Hebrew Academy. Adults enjoy a grown-up taste class, while kids enjoy Jewish stories, crafts, and activities with excellent THA teachers. There's no fee or obligation, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Mila Vassar at 520-327-4501 for more information and to register today. That's 520-327-4501.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be the Israeli and world music star Idan Reichel of the Idan Reichel Project. Our playout this morning comes from the upbeat song Ashrei, a setting of the famous psalm, Happy Are Those Who Dwell in Your House. This coming week, our house is a booth outdoors for the coming holiday of Sukkot, starts Wednesday night. This Ashrei is sung by the extremely energetic Yeshiva Boys Choir. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and definitely a Chag Sameach, a delightful and joy-filled holiday of Sukkot.